This is episode 152 of That Shakespeare Life. Today's episode is brought to you by Experience Shakespeare. Experience Shakespeare is the membership arm of That Shakespeare Life that offers you monthly digital history activity kits that let you try at home the history you learn about on the show. They work like science labs for history. Stay tuned after the episode for even more details.
Hi, I'm David Horobin, author, historian, and joint director of the British Archives of Falconry. Another great method for exploring the life of Shakespeare includes listening to this, It's That Shakespeare Life, with my friend Cassidy Cash.
The two most important places for public execution, particularly for commoners, were Smithfield, where quartering or burning happened, and Tyburn, which is present-day Hyde Park corner, where hanging was done.
Welcome to That Shakespeare Life with Cassidy Cash. Cassidy believes that if you desire to successfully learn or perform Shakespeare's plays, then understanding the real life and history of William Shakespeare himself is a must. That Shakespeare Life is the podcast that helps you go beyond the curtain of some of Shakespeare's most iconic works and explore the world of early modern England as Shakespeare would have lived it, learning from the writers, historians, and performers who know it best. And now, here's Cassidy.
Walking across London Bridge may seem like a merry thing to do, or perhaps even a dismissible part of your daily commute if you happen to live in London today. And while travel across the bridge was normal for William Shakespeare, what was decidedly different when he was doing it is that the South Gate featured heads of executed traitors on display for everyone to see. Along with these severed heads on display, public hangings, disembowelment, and even burning someone at the stake were all very much forms of public entertainment during Shakespeare's lifetime, drawing crowds that would walk for miles just to come and attend these executions. We can see the culture of public executions echoed in Shakespeare's plays and those of his contemporaries, along with how they choose to display or avoid the presentation of these kinds of deaths on stage in their productions. Here today to take us back to early modern England and walk us through the reasons, methods, and place of public execution in Shakespeare's lifetime, along with why Shakespeare may have chosen to handle the deaths the way he did in his works, is our guest, Murat Oğucu. Murat Oğucu received his PhD degree from Hacettepe University, Turkey, in 2016. From August of 2012 to January of 2013, he was a visiting scholar at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He has been the head of the Department of Western Languages and Literatures at Münzer University, Turkey, from 2016 onwards. He is a researcher at the AHRC-funded project Medieval and Early Modern Orients that aims to contribute to our understanding of the medieval and early modern encounters between England and the Islamic world. He has written book chapters and articles on his research interests that include early modern studies, Shakespeare, and cultural studies. See a list of his recent essays along with where he has been published and how you can connect with Murat in the show notes for today's episode. Hello, Murat. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
In film recreations of public executions, there's usually a loud, roaring crowd attending. Murat, how accurate is that representation for the 16th century? Would people have come out to attend a public execution in the same way they might have gone to the theater for entertainment?
Well, it's a yes and no, as there are varying degrees of mythicization of the notion of public execution through our modern lenses in various media. Public execution has been a sociopolitical ritual since the dawn of humankind, as a form of exerting power and restoring order by ritually sacrificing someone, not necessarily the wrongdoer, to cleanse society from the contamination of the wrongdoing, for example, stake. So it's a both backward and forward-looking through retribution and restoration. The fact that it is an irreversible verdict once it has been executed is the crux that has made public executions a matter of fear and awe, which, whether shown or narrated afterwards, creates a certain form of catharsis in the audience, who might feel pity and or relief that they are not the ones to be executed. In the early modern period, the proximity of the raised scaffold of the execution sites and that of the thrust stage of the early modern stage naturally created a shared manner of audienceship that often competed with each other to wrestle capital from the real or fictive capital punishments, which could be compared to that of reality shows, of course, in apocalyptic movies and series with dragons in streaming services. And both audiences were very noisy and actively engaged with the show they were presented and strongly expressed their content and discontent with a free voice. Both public executions and theaters could be regarded as events for public consumption that had their own economy, like when victuals were served to the crowds, or at least the printed versions could be bought afterwards of the executions and the plays, to which audiences had consciously spent their time and money. For instance, depending on where you were living, you had to spend at least half or an hour to walk to Smithfield or Tyburn to see public executions that could be seen once in a week or every 2 weeks, depending on the time, to which people literally flocked, according to our sources. Apart from these similarities, the dramatic or diegetic representation of public executions on the early modern stage created what Foucault referred as heterotopia, which merged spaces associated to executions of the past, the present, the theatricals, the historical ones, and the real ones. Contrary to the sites of real public executions, the stage enabled the release of several and often conflicting sets of reactions to the idea of public executions, while, relatively speaking, enabling the audience to stay on the safe side of politics.
Not all executions were done publicly. We can mention Anne Boleyn or even Robert Devereux, executed in England in 1601 when William Shakespeare was 37, that death was done privately in the Tower of London. Marat, we can see that not everyone sentenced to capital punishment in Shakespeare's lifetime was killed openly in the public square. So how was the location determined?
So of course, Cassidy, the early modern period was a socially conscious period, and the locations for and types of executions varied according to crime and the social status of the wrongdoer and the wronged. Social status was determined by the interconnected elements of estate, occupation, religion, gender, and age, which created multiple sets of relationships in certain networks that cannot be downgraded to, let's say, our modern understanding of rich versus poor, or men versus women. So we can say, just like society, punishments were hierarchized, they were regulated, calculated, and in which motive, person, place, time, quality, and quantity were analyzed to define the relationship between the wrongdoer and the wrongdoing and give due punishment. And the reason why some of these wrongdoers were relatively privately executed at the Tower of London, which somehow exempted them from the strong reactions of the audiences, like the public, I mean, that is verbal and physical violence of the spectators, mostly they were politically oriented, and in which the state wanted to suppress reactions towards the execution, execution of the ones who were closely related to the crown, such as because of matters like succession or treason. And from my research, I can say that the very concealment of these executions could actually not suppress the murmur of the public, but made things worse by leaving the particularities to the imagination of the public, who made things up usually. For example, after the execution of the Earl of Essex, there were reports of strange rumors where it was noised about that there were three rainbows seen in the tower and a scepter appearing in the place where the Earl was executed. And others would tell that a bloody block were seen by the guards, which was falling from the heaven upon that spot where the Earl was executed. So while executions were done publicly, especially those that were done publicly, could give some observable proofs about the justice of verdicts, private executions within the Tower of London made it a space of higher matters that should not be meddled at all, and which turned the tower, which was a place of imprisonment, torture, and executions, into a panoptical symbol of fear and awe itself.
Shakespeare's plays depict eye gouging, decapitation, being buried alive, and other forms of pretty dramatic deaths, which seem at first like exaggerated ways to kill someone for the sake of a performance. But Marat, were public executions in Shakespeare's England just as dramatic as some of the things we see in his plays? What were some of the ways people were publicly executed under Elizabeth I, for example?
They were, Cassidy. As I mentioned earlier, apart from the Tower of London, the two most important places for public execution, particularly for commoners, were Smithfield, where quartering or burning happened, and Tyburn, which is present-day Hyde Park corner, where hanging was done, and which also depended on the crime and the culprit. In any case, the condemned would be publicly paraded from where he or she was held, usually from Newgate, Clink, or Marshalsea prisons, which were, relatively speaking, in the center of London, and to the places of executions where you would see the public humiliation of the culprit through insulting, spitting, throwing objects from rotten food to anything imaginable as part of the ritual cleansing of society where most part of society would pour its hatred onto the soon to be executed. Traitors to the monarch were hanged, they were drawn and quartered, that is, they were elevated via a rope on their neck to suffocate for a while. They would be disemboweled and castrated, and finally they were mutilated and decapitated, and the body parts would be sent to four corners of the city, which were later displayed. During and after the disemboweling and mutilation, certain body parts, such as the heart, would be shown as humoral manifestations of the righteousness of the verdict, like when the heart would have too much blood, it would be shown as like that the wrongdoer was out of order and the like. And traitors to the Anglican God, especially, like witches and religious dissenters, would be burned at stake to clean off heresy and also somehow mimic how heretics would burn in hell afterwards, almost like a medieval mystery play, but for real. But the paradox of Christ's mercy versus God's wrath against sinners could be seen in the shaky bases of justification and reaction towards the execution of religious dissenters and witches. In particular, of course, religious dissenters like Catholics, especially Jesuit missionaries and Puritans, considered themselves as martyrs and their executions as murders. They said their innocence would be exhibited by their burned and scattered body parts, and which would preach their truth, their own truth. And finally, we have non-political and non-religious offenders who would be usually hanged at the so-called Tyburn tree, that had three sides of horizontal poles that enabled the hanging of the dozens of people simultaneously, which was like a cost-efficient assembly line. But no matter how one was executed, public execution created a legal and social stain for the past and future of one's family members that deprived them of reputation, and their material belongings were confiscated by the state. The disgrace of which, even if pardoned by the monarch, would stay in the consciousness of the people forever.
When it comes to staging these kinds of public executions in his plays, for Shakespeare, there's a theme of these public hangings or deaths by execution taking place off stage. Murat, was the theater technology not available for Shakespeare to be able to stage these types of complicated death scenes like a hanging or a decapitation? Or was there a political reason Shakespeare might have chosen to not show executions on stage?
Well, that's a really tough question. Thank you. Initially, I wanted to delve on this further, which for the time being I have to postpone. But there were instances of onstage executions in early modern drama, like in Spanish tragedy, where Horatio was hanged on stage and he was left there. The executions of Thomas and Rachel Mary in the two lamentable tragedies. And the not staged and censored Sir Thomas More had a hanging of a common, just to name a few. Usually, the technology involves certain knotting techniques and the use of temporary constructions or the use of the trapdoor at the ceiling of the theaters. So there was a technology, but the reasons for not staging public executions were manifold. From my research, most of the scandal-mongering pamphlets or plays about stories of people executed in the early modern period, they concentrated not on the result, but on the causes, as the execution of people created curiosity regarding their backstory. Another reason could be that what exactly public executions had been were too obvious for the audience, who could easily reenact the terror about them through the memorial reconstructions of real ones, conflating them with the narration of theatrical ones. So possibly the reason why there is an increasing amount of blood and gore in 20th and 21st century movies and series, for instance, could be that comparatively for most part of the Western world, the amount, frequency, and probability of seeing bloodshed for the majority of the population has increased. But going back to Shakespeare, I guess the reason for him to avoid the depiction of public executions on stage was more a dramaturgical one rather than a political. The narration of hanging, for instance, of Bardolph or Nym in his Henry V enabled him to justify the king's order to kill off his friends because they breached the law. On the contrary, showing their executions would probably create some sort of sympathy towards them because these characters have been just comic scoundrels up to that. Likewise, leaving the aftermath of the order to execute the rebelling lords earlier in the play, who attempted to assassinate Henry V, would first slow down the pace of the play, and because the king was moving towards his campaign against France. And second, it would prevent the comparison between the rebelling nobles and that of the eager commoners, who even sold their belongings just to enlist to the king's war. So rather than a political reasons, the depictions of execution like killings of even kings like Henry VI and Richard III had been shown on the stage, and they were printed in the quarto versions. The reason why we do not have, for the majority of his plays, mimetic depictions of public executions would be more related to dramaturgy and artistic choice.
Marat's work draws attention to a class distinction that determines specifically how someone might die for their crimes. Marat, you've mentioned this a couple of times here today, but in his paper, Public Execution and Justice on and Off the Elizabethan Stage, Shakespeare's first tetralogy, Marat draws attention to Eleanor, wife of Humphrey of Gloucester, who, after being accused of witchcraft in Shakespeare's Henry VI Part II, was not burned at the stake for being a witch, as was customary. But instead, she's banished to the Isle of Man, specifically because she was, quote, more nobly born. Marat, why are the punishments for specific crimes like witchcraft in early modern England varied based on nobility?
Well, as I've also mentioned earlier, despite its fading importance, early modern people were conscious of hierarchies, which basically distinguished the noble from the commoner. This was also extended to the places and ways of execution. The beheading of the nobility, for instance, was considered almost like a privilege that differentiated them from commoners, as it has lesser pain compared to other forms of executions, and they didn't want to create a proximity between the nobility and the commoners by executing the nobility like the commoners, like through burning or through quartering or whatever, because this proximity would lead to the questioning of distinctions, which would even go upwards to question the distinction between the royalty and the other subjects. So verdicts about the nobility were carefully laid out. Another reason was that the nobility were not just flesh and blood people, but to them, mobile and immobile wealth was attached. And how the royalty could benefit from it was also a decisive matter on the fate of the wrongdoing noblemen and noblewomen. For example, after the insurrection of the Earl of Essex, some leaders were eliminated, whereas the greater part of the dissenting noblemen were tried to be reintegrated into the system. By sparing some of the nobles from punishment in return for ransom, this scent was turned into loyalty, and these extra financial means were levied on the nobility. And we are talking about hundreds and thousands of pounds sterling, which would be decade-long incomes of commoners, comparatively speaking. So an act of mercy shown to others could lower social pressure following the execution of prominent figures. And the rebelling nobility could be maintained within the system by restricting their financial means further as a preferable alternative to capital punishment. But not just for being a noble, there were some other means to evade punishment, although like briefly by claiming to be pregnant, as could be seen in even in an 80-year-old sorceress in 1593, or more permanently by reciting the neck verse, that is Psalm 51, which is about God having mercy upon people, which saved, for instance, Ben Jonson for killing the actor Gabriel Spencer in 1598 in a duel. And moreover, apart from the reality that much condemned prisoners either lay at prisons for an indefinite time or were executed, to create an example, there were frequent instances of royal pardons, either sending condemned male prisoners as cannon fodder to the front, as in 1596, or releasing them, to show the mercy of the monarch, as in 1595, when 8 men and 8 women were pardoned by Elizabeth I. So there were ways out of law when you or someone read between the lines for you.
With one primary aim of public executions being to prevent riots, as you say, among the people and incite this order on fear of death, it seems liable to create anger over unfairness for the punishments to vary based on whether or not you could prove your nobility. I think of Henry Tudor, for example, where there was a great divide and indeed disagreement over his claim to the throne, due basically to how one person would interpret his genealogy versus someone else. Were there similar instances with public execution where there was a significant enough disagreement over the public execution that society revolted in response to the choice of the crown?
Yes, there were, Cassidy, and the frequency and volume of these were closely related with periods of economic recession, which were either due to crop failure or pestilences, which made the people less being able to swallow socio-political suppression. So the scaffold could become a place where social order could be turned upside down by the culprit and his or her followers. And there were especially two groups of people that showed their discontent at, for them, the unfair punishment of their fellow members. The first group consists of religious dissenters on both sides of the spectrum, from Jesuits to subgroups of Puritans, in which the former had an underground network since they were openly persecuted, whereas the Puritans were able to display their affiliations and create visible public pressure. For example, when a Puritan, Roger Ripon, was executed in 1593, his fellow sectarians placed his coffin at the door of a judge and spread many flyers that criticized how Elizabethan judges abused their power and murdered the said Ripon, who for them was actually a good Christian and a faithful servant to the monarchy. But of course, you could also have riots because the culprit's execution was prolonged, like that of a William Hacket, who proclaimed himself as a messiah, challenged the regime, and gathered a huge crowd in 1591 before being arrested. Polarizing society at his final hours, not his followers, but his opponents gathered around him. And when Hacket continued with his blasphemy, the out-of-control crowd got so furious that they demanded his immediate execution. The executors even got their share of the crowd's anger for being slow in the execution. So you could have both reactions about rioting. The second group of people consists of apprentices whose youth, confined within the suppressive constraints of patriarchy and feudalism, created friction among them and the establishment. Showing their discontent at the unfair imprisonment and dealings throughout the 1590s, the most important ones were the 1595 Tower Hill insurrections that primarily protested against high inflation, and they also blamed the immigrants for this, where the apprentices subverted their punishment by being put into pillories, by tearing them into pieces, and avenging their fellow apprentices' deaths by erecting a gallows in front of the door of the Lord Mayor. They even attempted to seize Tower Hill, which could be seen as an attempt to seize the panoptical presence of the executive powers of the judicial system, which they perceived to be unjust. But the proclamation against unlawful assemblies, which was proclaimed on the 4th of July 1595, forbidding to go out into the streets in the evening to riot or be knowing of any kind of seditious bills, or help rioters, and the disemboweling of the of at least 5 of these young insurrectors 20 days later could be effectively suppress disorders. So public execution could become a catalyst of social criticism and even get out of control, at least for a while.
Again, in Henry VI, Part 2, Suffolk is killed by commoners who take the law into their own hands, acting against not only established law, but against their station as well. How reflective of real life was this instance, Murat? For early modern England, were there ever justifications for killing someone outside of the law?
So first of all, except for self-defense, the killing was on a legal basis almost never justified. Despite the honor code modified via the Italian shame culture made honor a matter of life and death and increased duels and honor killings in the early modern period. Yet both religiously and legally, these killings were condemned and persecuted, the repercussion of which can be seen in early modern drama, where duels and honor killings are eventually punished by death. Like when in the Revengers tragedy, Vindice is to be executed off the stage for avenging his sweetheart Gloriana, or Hamlet must die because he was forced to take matters into his own hands because of Law's delay and the insolence of office. But starting with the late Elizabethan period and extending to the Jacobean and Caroline periods, things got so worse that the killing of people outside the law, almost in certain time periods, became the unwritten law when the justice system failed to amend wrongdoing. In principle, imprisonment, torture, and public execution were performative means used to represent the executive powers of the monarch against wayward subjects who dared to question his or her prerogatives and policies. But corruption in the judiciary system questioned the very validity of the performance of justice, seen especially when might overruled right in people who were near and dear to the crown. This was especially valid for one John Lamb, who rose from being a self-proclaimed astrologer and physician to the advisor of the Duke of Buckingham in 1625. Apart from being a quack doctor and a hope monger who used black magic, which attracted both followers and discontent people about his dealings, John Lamb's rape of an 11-year-old girl, Joan Seeger, in 1626, when Lamb was 75 years old, was the decisive turning point for him and also for the people. Despite receiving the death penalty, because of his connections to Buckingham and to the crown, he was pardoned and could postpone the execution indefinitely, which sounds very familiar, doesn't it? His wrongdoings that were hushed under the carpet, however, accelerated hatred against him and the crown. Lamb changed his whereabouts to avoid the public, but interestingly enough, after seeing a play, he was stoned to death in 1628 by an angry mob which was frustrated at how might circumvent his right. This killing outside the law was decisive to embolden the public that was usually quite carefully about remaining within the law. They voiced their criticisms against the nepotism even more, like in ballads that said, quote, "Let Charles and George do what they can, the Duke shall die like Dr. Lamb," unquote. And shortly after this, Buckingham was also assassinated by a military officer who felt mistreated for not getting the promotion he deserved. When the assassin John Felton was executed and sent back to Portsmouth, where the Duke was killed, to show the state's power to the public, it literally backfired, as people venerated the body of Felton. Both instances show that because of the injustices the legal system could not cure, taking matters into one's own hands and defying the sacred body of anyone associated with the crown became possible, which was decisive in the long term to overthrow Charles I and execute him, reversing the power relations exerted through public executions.
After Suffolk dies in Henry VI Part II, there's a scene where his head is on Margaret's lap in a very public display of his death. Murat, were the heads of executed prisoners displayed in England after they died?
Yes, they were. The display of heads and or body parts was more than a sadistic ritual, as these were used to externalize and concretize crimes that were basically inert and abstract phenomena. The political and legal digression of the culprit, like treason, through sedition or attempted assassination, would be reenacted in the inversion of his body by making the inner organs, outer ones through disemboweling and by castration to show that the wrongdoer's progeny will never prosper because of his crime, and by decapitation to show how his high aspirations to become the head of something cost his own hand. The organs and body parts would be shown on the execution site to the public to prove and justify the culprit's deserved death. But the most famous venue, apart from execution places for displaying, especially the heads of traitors, was London Bridge. But the name Bridge should not fool you, as different from our present understanding of bridges, London Bridge was like a living entity, almost like a district of its own, with lots of buildings on it, like the chapel of St. Becket, hundreds of shops and hundreds of houses. But the heads of traitors were not placed all over the bridge, but to the southern gate of London Bridge, as that gate was a liminal space and threshold between what was inside and outside London. So instead of a welcome to London sign, the heads would be like a not-so-friendly reminder to those who did not know what would happen to traitors. According to my research, the heads would be put into tar and also other preservative materials to postpone their degradation, and they would be placed on iron spears so that technically they would not touch the walls of London, and they would also be seen from both sides of the bridge from a relative distance. So seeing a decapitated head on the stage, although gross for modern audiences, was actually an everyday real sight for early modern ones.
In Henry VI, Part 3, Shakespeare depicts the Duke of York being made fun of through a paper crown. Later, his head is put on a pole and displayed after his execution. Murat explains in his paper that the lines and events given to the Duke of York as well as Queen Margaret in that play reflect real events happening in England when the play was written. Murat, please share with us how the responses of York's son Richard mirror the opinions of one Elizabethan Swiss traveler who wrote about the effectiveness of placing heads on pikes on London Bridge in the 16th century.
Sure, Cassidy. In the play, the Duke of York's belittlement on a molehill with a paper crown intended to show York's deviant behavior and also to parodically mimic his aspirations and to cleanse with him the Yorkist aspirations to the crown. But this type of show also showed that public executions and trials preceding them could be used as mere political shows rather than that of justice. For instance, 2 years after the play's production, the leaders of a group of Puritans, Barrow and Greenwood, who were about to be released, were hanged at Tyburn in 1593 because of the malice of the bishops towards the lower house, because the dislike shown one day before to the bishop's bill against Puritans. Similarly, the 20-minute trial of the Catholic priest Robert Southwell in 1595, in which Richard Popcliffe, the notorious chief enforcer against religious dissenters, just poured a bag full of letters without having read them aloud, showed that trials were actually fabricated excuses for executions that aimed to contain dissent by ritually executing political opponents, displaying the body parts and impaling the heads of especially traitors, were in a way extensions of these. Historically, the Duke of York's head was displayed on Micklegate Bar on the city walls of York. And in the play, one of his sons, Edward, the later Edward IV, was very discouraged at seeing his father's head on a pole, which in a way shows the effectiveness of impaling the heads of beheaded nobility as a reminder of how deviant behavior would end, and which would also discourage any further attempts in the future. But York's other son, Richard, the future Richard III, took the narration of the impaled head as a means for self-esteem, to revenge his father's death, or at least to die renowned by attempting it. And Richard's response was reflective of an account of Hanser, a Swiss traveler, who maintained that descendants took pride in seeing their ancestors' head on the walls of London Bridge, which was subverting the disloyal deviants into a kind of heroic defiance. So while the trials, mutilations, display of body parts, and impaling of heads intended to create a formal history visible to onlookers, the very act of gazing, which is inherently unstable, created a space for informal receptions that rejected public executions as a formal marginalization from society.
When we say that criminals who were publicly executed had their heads placed on pikes and displayed on London Bridge, you mentioned that this was an everyday occurrence, but what kind of volume are we talking about? Were you walking across the bridge on any given day? Were there always heads there? Or how many would be displayed as you're walking up to the bridge and see it there at the south gate?
As an early modernist, I can say that we have several sources that give us an approximate number of them. legal documents, eyewitness accounts, and depictions of panoramic views that show London Bridge might be taken as reference points, though the last named engravings or pictures of London Bridge, like that of Weingart or One We Share, might have taken some artistic license. One of the sources we already mentioned is the Swiss traveler Henser, who noted in his diary that there were, around the year 1599, more than 30 heads of noblemen and also gentry who were executed for high treason. Their heads were placed on iron spikes, as he says, or spears, and the approximately 10-minute walk distance between the theaters in Southwark, like the Rose, Swan, and Globe theaters, and the southern gate of London Bridge made any reference to decapitated traitor characters in early modern drama very topical. The exposure of executed heads in everyday life became panoptical reminders of the consequences of treason. But what constituted treason became a contested matter as times changed and according to who was labeling these people as ones. Ever-changing formal histories clashed with relatively constant personal family histories that defied public executions as a means to inhibit heterodoxy, which actually problematized the very idea of sacrificial catharsis through public executions, as they were and have been not an effective means to retribute or give full satisfaction to the wronged or the culprit. As the death penalty, neither does lower crime satisfy the wronged or persuade the families of the executed that such a verdict is just.
I know we would love to explore this topic further. What are some of your favorite books or resources you can recommend we use to learn more?
Many thanks, Cassidy. Of course, there are a ton of works about the subject, but as a preliminary reading, I would suggest René Girard's Violence and the Sacred and Michel Foucault's Discipline and Punish to understand the historical and psychological background behind capital punishment as a sacrificial ritual to clean society of digressions and maintain it. Then I would recommend John Weatherford's Crime and Punishment in the England of Shakespeare and Milton, which covers much of how capital punishment was perceived and received in the early modern period. Tristan Dieter's The Tower of London in English Renaissance Drama, Icon of Opposition, would be also on my list for outlining how the tower and the other places for executions could become spaces of social suppression as well as subversion. And finally, I would recommend Frederica Bain's very recent book entitled Dismemberment in the Medieval and Early Modern English Imaginary, which has meticulously written chapters on capital punishment, apart from those about other forms of gruesome forms of dismemberment. But while reading any books on public execution, I would recommend doing a slow reading, as the subject matter is not a merry one.
Those are excellent resources to start with and good advice about making sure you go through it slow. We'll link to all of these resources as well as Murat's work that you can read in the show notes for today's episode, so make sure you go there to find those. Murat, we ask everyone this next question here at That Shakespeare Life, and that's, what's the one book you would take with you on a deserted island? My friends in England tell me I'm supposed to allow you the complete works of Shakespeare and a copy of the Bible, so your choice would be in addition to those.
So I guess the second item for me would be the Quran, but if it were possible, I would exchange the books with my family. As whatever you like and your beliefs are, they stay with you forever, even if you don't have books about them. I have been forced to commute more than 600 kilometers between my job and my family on a weekly basis for the last 5 years, and somehow know in these days, without my family, how to feel what it is to be in a deserted island. But if the rules do not permit such an exchange, I would at least like to have a book about my family to help me remember things before the divide between reality and imagined would blur, living alone for a long time.
That is a brilliant selection, and I think the most philosophical choice we've had here on That Shakespeare Life. What is next for you? What are you working on now that you're excited about?
Actually, there are a couple of ongoing projects, both in Turkish and in English, ranging from publications about Henry V and weapons, space studies and Richard II, Shakespeare and narratology, Milton and Turkish, and many more. But the one I am currently most excited about is a collection of essays I'm working on. Together with Medieval and Early Modern Orients, I and Aisha Hussein are editing a volume that will analyze how stage architecture, costume, and effects of performance affect the conceptualization of the East on the commercial outdoor and indoor stage and on the performance spaces in university plays. And the call for papers is out, and we are looking forward to receiving abstracts until the 15th of March. Thank you very much. I really enjoyed talking to you and hope our listeners will also enjoy it as much as I have done.
Yes, thank you so much. Yeah, that is exciting work. I'll be excited to see that come to fruition. Hopefully we can talk to you again once you've published that. Thank you so much, Murat, for being here. This has been a fun conversation. If you'd like to dive even further into the history of public executions in Shakespeare's lifetime, including links to the cases of John Lamb and William Hackett and other things that Murat mentions in today's episode, along with pictures and archival images and all of the history we could pack in there, find the show notes at CassidyCash.com/episode152. That's CassidyCash.com/EP152. Don't forget that the video version of our show is now streaming on our YouTube channel. You can find that at youtube.com/C/CassidyCash. And if you would like to have all the video versions of our show, along with documentaries, animated plays, virtual tours, and more, be sure to check out the streaming app for That Shakespeare Life at CassidyCash.com/experience. That's CassidyCash.com/experience. That's it for this week. Thank you for being here. I'm Cassidy Cash, and I hope you learned something new about the Bard. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to That Shakespeare Life. As always, the best conversations happen after the episode over at CassidyCash.com. Become a part of a vibrant Shakespeare conversation by adding your voice over at the website. Until next time, remember, when you want to know William Shakespeare, you have to go behind the curtain and into That Shakespeare Life.